All right, good morning, counsel. Our next case is the Mitchell Law Firm versus Bessie Jean Worthy Revocable Trust. And we'll first hear from the appellant whenever you're ready, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Greg Mitchell for the appellants, and may it please the court. I believe that the issues in this case are fairly straightforward, Your Honors. The first two are intertwined and relate to standing. Does the appellee herein have standing to have even appeared in this case? And number two, if so, whether appellee's actual appearance in the original trial court matter prevents him from collaterally attacking the judgment. Appellants urge that no matter how you answer the first question, you ultimately must rule against appellees. If on the one hand, appellee does not have standing, then that concludes the inquiry and the trial court erred in even considering appellee's Rule 60B motion. If on the other hand, appellee has standing, then it is only as the substitute for the real party in interest, Larry Hodge. And if that's the case, then appellee appeared in the original trial court case with counsel and consented to a judgment. Appellee had the opportunity to object to jurisdiction then and cannot now collaterally attack the judgment rendered. The third and final issue relates to the district court's order that appellant return monies received for services provided. We believe that under the court's own rationale, if it had no jurisdiction over the parties, then it had no jurisdiction to order the return of funds received. But from a more fundamental standpoint, we believe that any such order would be premature based on the current status of the parties. I'll start with the last issue, which I'll reference as issue number three, and then work my way back to the first two. And in addressing issue number three, I'll pick up where I left off in the introduction regarding the current status of the parties. I think it's important that we keep in mind where we are right here today. As we sit here today, all we have are fees that were charged, fees that were approved by the then administrator and trustee with authority to approve, and then fees that were paid. If there was anything inappropriate about the fees that were charged, then the appellee herein has every right to file suit against appellant. And importantly, as is reflected in the record and in the briefs, appellee has in fact filed suit against appellate in the probate court. That suit alleges causes of action that, if found in his favor, could in fact lead to a judgment requiring appellant to return those fees. That litigation is pending and ongoing. If there was anything inappropriate in the then administrator and trustee Larry Hodge approving of those fees, then that too can be addressed in the context of the current litigation in probate court, because that suit names both appellant herein and Larry Hodge, the then administrator and trustee. And if there was anything inappropriate in the bank paying those fees, that too can also be addressed in the context of the current litigation in probate court. I can tell you that appellee has in fact raised just about every one of those issues in litigation in the probate court. And although the entire record of the state court action is not in this record, there are documents from that case that are in this record. And I think this court could at least take judicial notice of the existence of that case. But in any event, I think the important point to take away is that to the extent that anything regarding the payment of those fees was inappropriate, then appellee has recourse in the state court. But again, I come back to where we are today, and that is simply fees being charged, approved by the party with authority to approve, and then paid. It is simply unnecessary to require a return of the fees in order to put the parties back where they were, because where they were was that the fees had been incurred, approved by the person who had the authority at the time to approve, and paid. Everything else at this point is simply allegations of wrongdoing. So now returning to issues one and two, to start with a big picture perspective, appellees have sort of backed themselves into a corner. And by that, I mean they can't have it both ways. If appellee has standing to be here, as he asserts, it can only be as the substitute administrator and trustee, because otherwise he was just a beneficiary at the time of the district court case. We submit that Rodney Hodge does not have standing to be here today. And the reason for that is the Texas case law that we cited in our brief, finding that the real party in interest in a suit involving a trust or an estate is the trustee or administrator, respectively. At the time of the underlying suit in the district court in 2016, the real party in interest was Larry Hodge, who was the trustee of the trust and administrator of the estate at the time. There's no other party that could have been sued. Larry Hodge, not Rodney Hodge, was the contracting party for legal services. At that time, Rodney Hodge was simply a beneficiary, and he was never a party to the contract for legal services. We also point to case law in our brief, in particular, the Texas Supreme Court's decision in Huey versus DeShazo, 922 Southwest 2nd, 920, Texas Supreme Court case from 1996, where the Texas Supreme Court explicitly rejected the notion that a trust or estate itself is the true party in interest. Now, having said all that, if we're wrong and Rodney Hodge does have standing, we believe appellant still wins. And that is because, once again, if Rodney Hodge has standing to appear, then it could only be as a substitute trustee or substitute administrator. And in that case, then the fact that he's a substitute representative of the real party means that the real party in interest was present and appeared in the original suit in 2016. Importantly, the representative of the trust and estate appeared with counsel and therefore had every opportunity to object to jurisdiction.
Do you agree that now, looking at it, there was no jurisdiction and you're just saying, but there's preclusive effect? I mean, do you agree that we should look to the residency of the deceased and therefore there was no diversity?
We do agree with that principle, Your Honor, that it was a mistake, and it was my mistake. I take full credit for it. Honestly, I could make all sorts of excuses. I had never sued an estate. I knew that the representative of the estate lived in California, just made a mistake. So from that standpoint, we agree with the court's decision to the extent of the subject matter jurisdiction.
Then what about Judge Lynn's conclusion that, first of all, there was never a direct ruling on jurisdiction originally, and she says there's no preclusive effect to the implicit acceptance of jurisdiction because it was really not an adversarial suit. I mean, as I understand it, it was, I think, someone who shared an office with you was a counsel on the other side, and you'd filed this within days of the state court saying, no, you're not going to get fees from the state court. Respond to her point that there was really no adversarial nature of that first case that would warrant giving preclusive effect to any jurisdictional decision that might have implicitly been made.
Well, I think I would start by disagreeing with the initial point as to whether it was adversarial. The fact is that it was adversarial from the standpoint of an opposing party having counsel being represented. I think the fact of the matter is that Larry Hodge simply did not dispute the fees. Larry Hodge knew that the fees had been incurred.
What was your relationship with the original opposing counsel?
We have a relationship simply that we officed in the same office. There was no firm relationship. We've never worked in the same firm. We share office space, and it's not uncommon for either one of us to refer cases back and forth to each other. So
is it common for you to refer cases where you're suing each other?
Where we're suing each other. I mean, we weren't suing. I've never sued Ms. Lindauer, if I understand the question correctly.
I mean, do you refer cases to your co-counsel as the adversarial party?
That has happened in the past. I do a good amount of bankruptcy work, and so as does Ms. Lindauer. So on occasion, I have had a debtor in, and there has been a creditor come to me that I told them that I couldn't represent them, but I've referred them to Ms. Lindauer. I mean, obviously there, it's not something that's in the record that I can prove one way or the other. Ms. Lindauer and I operate separate firms. Even though we have office space together, you know, neither one of us are in the office that often because number one, we're both very busy. And number two, you know, I work from outside the office quite a bit, as does she. So it is something that has occurred. It's certainly not always the case when we refer cases back and forth. But no, it was not uncommon for something like that to have happened. So I believe that the case was adversarial, but nevertheless.
Did she know that the probate court had just rejected giving you paying your attorney's fees out of the estate funds?
Well, I guess let me first, I'll answer the question that to my knowledge, Ms. Lindauer had very little knowledge of the happenings of the probate court. However, I would somewhat dispute the characterization of the court's question or the foundation of the question. The probate court did never specifically rejected my fees. The probate court decided, and in subsequent communication, and I believe there's transcript in the record that specifically says that the court simply did not address that issue at that time. It was not rejected, and so I think it's an important distinction that the probate court did not look at the request for fees and say, no, we are denying that. The court simply did not rule on that request for expenses. And that was later clarified in a transcript in which the opposing party, Rodney Hodge, had sought an injunction. And there's a transcript in the record of Judge Chapman explaining that those fees were not denied, and for that reason he rejected the injunctive relief sought.
I'm unclear then though why you filed a federal suit. It's pending before the the court, state court, and ruled on it, and why you, and very, it appeared to me that very quickly you moved to get to the federal court.
Your Honor, I understand the question. I can tell you that there was no, rush to do anything other than the fact that the case had concluded. And so from my perspective, as it related to my relationship with Larry Hodge, the administrator and trustee,
But it was still open before you're saying it, the matter was still pending in the state court, and that it hadn't reached it yet. And then what you did was to engage another lawyer, that your client engaged your partner here with it, and the understanding that there would be no objection to the fee.
Well, what I was suggesting, Your Honor, was that there was the large portion of the representation of Mr. Hodge had concluded at that point. The state court case in which had gone to trial, and the jury had made its findings, the judgment had been rendered, and at that point, quite frankly, I was looking to get paid. And so as to why I chose federal court, there was no particular reason. I could have filed it in another state court. The probate court did not have any sort of exclusive jurisdiction over that issue. I chose federal court simply because at the time I thought it was appropriate. Obviously, I'm admitting to that mistake. I thought that there was complete diversity, when as it turns out there was not, based on the deemed jurisdiction of an estate. But nevertheless, there was no rush other than simply my representation is largely concluded, and therefore I'd simply like to be paid for the tremendous amount of work that had been done over a large period of time. So with the little time, I was pointing out that the representative had appeared with counsel, and that there was no objection made to the jurisdiction, even though there could have been. So as a result, we believe that the case law we cited regarding collateral attacks kicks in and precludes appellee from collaterally attacking the judgment. And I would point to this court's ruling in Brown versus Illinois Centennial Railroad, where it said that even if the exercise of subject matter jurisdiction was erroneous, it is still res judicata and not subject to collateral attack through Rule 60b-4. And with that, I will yield the floor if there are no other questions.
All right, and yield your time for rebuttal. We'll now hear from Mr. McDonald whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Justice Costa, Higginbotham, and Odom. Thank you so much for the opportunity to argue in front of you today. I grew up in the New Orleans area, alumni of Tulane. Hope you enjoy the city as much as I do.
Miss it.
Yes, sir. Now, what strikes me most is if you review Judge Lynn's transcript of the hearing, her order, the appellant's argument that this was an accident is a fiction. It's clear from the pleadings, the procedural history of state probate court, and Judge Lynn herself even stated this is not accident, this is intentional. So Judge, with that, let's review some of the procedural history of the probate court. On July 2016, the appellate represented judges as Rodney Hodge and Larry Hodge. If it pleases the court, I'd like to just say Larry and Rodney so there's no confusion. Is that okay?
Sure.
So they had this jury trial, and Larry has found that he stole from the decedent while she was living pursuant to a power of attorney. Jury trial came back with that finding, Judge. On August 7th, 2016, appellant filed a motion to get money from the estate account. On August 22nd, 2016, state probate court denied that motion. On August 22nd, 2016, the same day the judge in state court, probate court denied the appellant's motion, he filed a motion for reconsideration. On August 6th, 2016, state probate court denied that motion for reconsideration. So at this point, he was denied access to the probate account, not once, but twice by the state probate court. And 2 days after, September 8th, it's 2 days after the second time the state probate court said no, he files this federal action that subject matter of this appeal to. September 10th, he adds the estate as a party, therefore destroying complete diversity, rendering the federal court not having subject matter jurisdiction. On September 16th, 8 days after that, an agreed judgment is entered into, granting the plaintiff all the relief requested. The whole time, the state probate court knew nothing of the federal proceedings. The attorneys for the two pending state probate court proceedings knew nothing about the federal proceedings. And Judge Lynn made it clear she knew nothing about the state probate proceedings. Had she have known, she would have kicked the petition out. On September 19, 2016, he sends the agreed order to Citizens National Bank and converts an excess of $78,000 to his benefit. So with that being in mind, let's look at the 3 points. Yes, the appellee definitely has standing. 2, the judgment is void and subject to collateral attack. And 3, the district court has inherent authority to order the return of money converted by the appellant. First, Judge, let's just do a general introduction about standing. If you look at, just to simply review the appellate's complaint and amended complaint, he's suing the estate. On his sole argument, he doesn't have the standing to bring the complaint or the amended complaint when he did. So his own argument defeats his claim today, Judge. Second, let's look at standing of the administrator. Texas Estate Code 361.153c1 states that a successor representative may make himself or herself and may be made a party to a suit prosecuted by or against the successor's predecessors. Kind of a tongue twister there. Second, Estate Code 351.351, a personal representative is required to use ordinary diligence to collect all claims and debts due to the estate and to recover possession of all property of the estate to which its owners have a claim or title. 3, the appellee was required to seek relief from the agreed final judgment because of his role as personal representative of the estate. As a result, the appellee is a proper party to do so because the successor representative may make himself a party to the suit prosecuted by the successor's predecessors. Now, as for the trustee, Judge, standing of the trustee, the Texas Trust Code provides that in an action by or against a trustee in all proceedings concerning trust, having and serving a trustee, the trustee is a necessary party. That's Webb and Texas Property Code 111.00. The appellant does not dispute that Lowry was trustee at the time that the underlying action was filed, that the trust has a stake in the proceedings, or that Rodney is the lawfully appointed successive trustee. Therefore, Rodney has standing with respect to the trust. At this point, we establish his standing in respect to the trust and his standing in respect to the estate. And in review of 60B, in cases that are part of 60B, Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, it states that a court may relieve a party or its legal representative from a final judgment. The general rule is that one must either be a party or legal representative in order to have standing to bring Rule 60B. That's correct, Judge. From the time Rodney was appointed as Lowry's successor, he stepped into Lowry's shoes, becoming the legal representative of the estate and trust, and acquiring standard to pursue relief on behalf of the estate and the trust. In summary, the appellee has standing to seek relief from the final judgment. The cases cited in review of the appellate's brief and reply brief, is cases just simply do not support his argument. If the appellate's rationale is correct, then the court didn't, if the appellate's rationale is correct, then the federal court didn't have jurisdiction to even decide his complaint or amended complaint. If you look at the motion for 60B, the original motion, it's filed Ronnie Hodge as successor administrator and trustee. Finally, the Ray Maluli case he cites states that a trust can be a proper party if it's not timely objected to. He never objected to the trust being a party, Judge, so therefore that argument is further moot. Finally, the appellant wants to discuss public policy. Well, let's talk about this public policy in the appellant's mind. You can have an administrator, a trustee, steal from the estate, steal from the trust, resign, have a successor appointed, and guess what? That successor can't do anything about it. That's the appellant's argument. That's how absurd it is. That's why it simply fails. And Judge, behind all the appellant's smoke and mirrors and illogical argument, the court never had subject matter jurisdiction over this case anymore. Second, Judge, judgment is void and subject to collateral attack. A void judgment is subject to both direct and collateral attack. That's Browning. A 60B4 motion from relief of judgment leaves no margin for consideration of district court's discretion because the judgment itself is by definition void or not. That's court.
Mr. McDonald, what do you want this court to do?
Sustain the district court's finding that the order is void. Sustain the district court's actions.
And with what result?
That the order is void and that that the appellant is ordered to return the funds that he converted.
And the funds go where?
Back to the estate to be distributed to the beneficiaries of the.
When they go back to the estate, what court has jurisdiction over that?
The court, the County Court of Law 1, which is the probate court in Ellis County, Judge.
Okay. They don't go directly. They go back to the custody of the court, essentially, probate court.
Yes, Judge. I mean, their estate funds, they were taken from the estate, so they have to go back to the estate.
And that court would make the decision as to the distribution.
Yes, Judge.
Okay. Would the question of the attorney's fees still be open at that juncture?
Well, Judge, we don't have, in state court right now, in the state probate court, we don't have a request for attorney's fees at this point on file for the appellant.
But somebody's got to approve the payment from the estate of the attorney's fees.
Yes, Judge, and I want to point out that on February 9, 2012.
Who would that be?
I'm sorry, Judge?
Who in the state court system would be the approving body for the payment of these fees?
That's Judge Jim Chapman. He's County Court of Law 1, Judge.
Okay, that's still before him?
Yes, Judge.
And that he would have some sort of a proceeding or any court appearances and make that judgment?
Yes, Judge.
Okay.
And Judge, I want to make the point known that when Larry was appointed in February 9, 2012, he had to seek authority from the court to expend any funds. And the assets in that account was held, they were held to a safekeeping agreement signed by the state probate judge. So not only was he not allowed access to that account twice, he broke the safekeeping agreement when he wrote to Citizen National Bank with the order requesting the amount of money in the estate account. So to go back to the collateral attack argument, appellants claims that the estate and trust had an opportunity to litigate subject matter jurisdiction, Judge, under the current proceeding is simply unconscionable. It's unconscionable because, as Judge Lynn stated herself in the transcript, because of the appellant's awful pleading and using the federal district court in a scheme to convert money from the state funds, the probate court denied him access to trust. The fees that the appellant sued for were personal fees. They were fees of Larry individually, not fees of the estate, not fees of the trust. So why were estate funds improperly used to pay Larry's individual legal fees? And once again, the cases cited by the appellant simply do not make sense. Insurance Corp of Ireland that he cites centers on personal jurisdiction and just simply do not support the statements regarding subject matter jurisdiction. Two cases are from the 1930s and do not apply. This case was filed with the original administrator and trustee while the administrator trustee were being actively removed in the state court, and Larry was removed as trustee and administrator. This case is purposely hidden from the state court, and the two attorneys working on state court issues and was adjudicated in 8 days, with the state court not knowing any of the federal actions and the federal court not knowing any of the state probate court actions. Therefore, the appellant relies on Brown. Upon reading Brown, it's an unpublished opinion that in itself states cannot be used as precedent. And what's shocking, Judge, is the appellant wants to talk about egregiousness. Upon a simple reading of the transcript in Judge Lynn's ruling, it is apparent how egregious Judge Lynn took Mr. Mitchell's actions. Mr. Mitchell's actions were so egregious that Judge Lynn was well within her jurisdiction to render the judgment she did. Thus, the district court has authority to order the return of monies received by the appellant. First, I'd like to point your attention to the hearing transcript, page 3, line 25 to page 4, line 1 through 4. Mr. Mitchell, in his own words, states, "We do not deny that the addition of the estate prevented the court from having complete diversity." He admitted to that today as well. So he admits the court has no subject matter jurisdiction. It is longstanding law that the district court has inherent judicial power to order restitution of property wrongfully obtained because of its erroneous avoid judgment. Northwestern case, Justice. Jurisdiction to correct what was wrongfully done must remain with the court so long as the parties and the cases are properly before it, either in the first instance or remanded by an appellate tribunal. In this case, similar to the Morgan case, the gist of the appellate's argument as well, the court doesn't have subject matter jurisdiction, so how can they order return of money? Well, the Supreme Court in that case said, well, money was placed into the registry of the court. Because the order was void, that money had to be returned to the person that put the money in the registry of the court because the order was void, the actions were not proper. That's simply what we're asking the court to sustain the district court's finding. As this court stated, the district court has inherent power of course to enforce the rights of restitution. This is now accepted as the general stance along all the appellate tribunals in the country. That's Henry Craig Stores of Texas. Finally, in the appellant's brief, page 14, paragraphs 9 through 10, the appellant states that he does not dispute that the district court has authority to correct what was wrongfully done. So,
McDonald, I was intrigued by your authorities, but I didn't hear you mention PICO. I didn't hear you mention the PICO case, the 1990 decision by Judge Garwood, which I take to be Mr. Mitchell's primary authority for this res judicata point. That is that once the district court erroneously asserts jurisdiction, that it can't be undone by a Rule 60b-4 motion. What's your stance on that?
Judge, if that addresses, I apologize, I don't have that case in front of me. If that addresses that the appellant had, the defendant had the exercise to attack jurisdiction at that time, there's an exception where the activity is egregious in 60B, and Judge Lynn notes herself how egregious the appellant's actions are. And number two, because of the fact that this was hidden from state probate court, hidden from all the attorneys working in the state, you know, probate court, it's our argument that the defendant didn't have the opportunity to attack jurisdiction. Plus, if you look at the whole facts, why would he attack it? This was a whole scheme orchestrated to get the funds. He was denied two twice. As long as money's not coming out of his pocket, why would he have an interest? That's why, out of equity, they say successor, trustee, successor, administrators have the ability to do what Ronnie has done in, you know, district court. Judge, does that help to, you know, does that address what you were, you know, questioning?
I appreciate your answer.
Thank you, Judge. Finally, by the appellant's own arguments, he admits subject matter jurisdiction is not there, and the court has authority to do what it wrongfully did because the judgment's void. In summary, Judge, the appellant's brief and reply briefs do not make sense or illogical, completely misinterpret the law, and just bluntly are just silly. The district court probably granted summary judgment in favor of appellees, finding that there was no subject matter jurisdiction. As successor administrator of the estate and successor of the trust, Ronnie had every right to bring what he brought before the district court and the appellate court today, Judge. And even though the district court lacked jurisdiction, it probably uses inherent jurisdiction in ordering appellate to return their money they received from the agreed final judgment to appellees. Just as with the time left, the appellee desires to leave you with a few points from the hearing transcript and Judge Lynn's ruling. These are Judge Lynn's words from the transcript of the 60B4 motion hearing. Page 4, line 19 to page 5, line 3. Just doesn't smell right. In essence, this case gets filed, all kinds of things are happening in state court I know nothing about. Mr. Larry Hodge was removed, and this went fail. Page 5, lines 4 through 10. The jurisdiction was created by your company, Mr. Mitchell, or through pleadings that suggest the estate was a resident of California. You knew the estate was a resident of Texas, didn't you? Page 6, line 23 to 25. There certainly was a lack of candor to the court. I'm extremely troubled by that. Page 6, line 10 through 17. I don't think this is accidental that you neglected to say how she died in Texas. I think you intended to do that. Page 9, lines 7 through 14. You're asking the state court to grant you attorney's fees. You're denied. You come here, do not plead jurisdiction properly, and eureka, the attorney's fees are awarded. Page 9, line 15 through 17. I'm disturbed by this and frankly sympathetic to the notion that this court may have gotten hoodwinked. Page 17, lines 4 through 5. This is a disturbing situation. Page 22, I think this court was misled. Page 23, lines 18 through 19. I'm very disturbed how this court, in my view, was misused and abused. Page 25, line 10. This is a serious matter in the court's view. I fear the court was actively misled. Page 25, lines 17 through 19. It's not accidental that you pled the way you did. Judge Lynn's ruling, the first sentence says it all, Judge. This case is about how plaintiff's withholding a key fact resulted in this court becoming an unwitting vehicle for plaintiff's improper acquisition of funds. One final note, Judge. I mean, the case law speaks for itself and the law is very clear. One final note, there's three beneficiaries. My two clients are two of them, Ronnie Hodge and Sherry Todd. They did not receive a cent from this estate. Larry had his attorney's fees paid by the estate, his individual attorney's fees. Mr. Mitchell converted in excess of $200,000 from the estate. Pretty much the whole estate went to an attorney, a federal bankruptcy attorney licensed in 7 federal jurisdictions with 24 years of experience. Justices, when attorneys act disintentionally and egregiously, it reflects on all of us. I respectfully request that the trial court order is sustained. Thank you.
All right, thank you, counsel. Mr. Mitchell, you get the last word with your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll kind of jump around a little bit to respond to points made by the appellee. I'll start with the last point and point out that all of the fees that were earned in this case on behalf of appellant were incurred as a direct result of the extremely lengthy litigation initiated by the appellee in this case. Larry Hodges' children simply decided to wage an all-out war, and his attorneys were happy to go along. We were always in responsive mode in relation to those fees. Moving on, appellee has repeatedly referred to Judge Lynn's observations as if they are evidence, but her comments only explain why we're here today. The court should defer to the state court in determining whether anything was improper. A ruling in favor of appellee today would essentially render a judgment in favor of appellee prior to a trial in the merits. And at this point, all appellee is relying on are allegations.
It would undo the entire federal case for which there was no jurisdiction to begin with. And then this can all be sorted out in state court.
We don't have a problem with that. I mean, the state court action is going to go forward.
Why are we here? What?
Well, I think primarily, Your Honor, we think that the law supporting our appeal is why we're here, because we don't believe that the district court acted properly. We believe that the appellee appeared and therefore is collaterally attacking a judgment that has no business attacking. And we believe that there is no need to order fees returned when all we have are allegations. I mean, appellee has repeatedly referred to the term conversion as if there had been a legal determination. Judge Higginbotham's question, Mr. McDonald claimed that they should be returned because they had been converted. But then Mr. McDonald had to acknowledge that there's been no decision regarding the payment of those fees. And that's consistent with my point that as we sit here today, all we have are fees incurred, fees approved, and fees paid. All we have on the other side are allegations. And then in response to Judge Oldham's question, Mr. McDonald could only point to these allegations. The trial court bypassed the principle law that a party that appeared can't collaterally attack a judgment by saying that Larry Hodge had been found to have breached his fiduciary duty to Ms. Worthy and that proceedings to remove him as administrator and trustee were pending. But in response to that, we would point out that the probate court had not found any impropriety in the payment of fees, and a finding of a breach of fiduciary duty by itself does not render the payment of fees inappropriate. There's plenty of case law cited in our brief in support of the notion that a fiduciary's use of funds under their purview is appropriate in a good faith defense of a breach of fiduciary duty. And our brief, I think, clearly explains how that defense was clearly in good faith. Rodney Hodges' suit had alleged that some $250,000 in expenses incurred were violative of Larry Hodges' fiduciary duty, but the jury only found a fraction of that in damages, an amount that was less than 20% of the total amount sought. That implies that with respect to the other 80%, there was good faith. And to that point, you don't even have to believe me. You can look at the state appellate court's decision that's in the record. Rodney appealed the judgment to the extent that they had been denied certain damages that were determined to be out of statute. In doing so, he alleged the application of the continuing tort doctrine. The state appellate court found, we believe correctly, that the continuing tort doctrine did not apply because the transactions were each discrete transactions and therefore not a continuous tort. And in so finding, the appellate court pointed to the fact that despite seeking over $250,000 in damages, the jury only awarded less than 20%. And after application of the statute of limitation, the actual amount was closer to 10%. So once again, we end up back to where at this point, the only thing we have are allegations of wrongdoing, and allegations should not alter a principle of law as it relates to the collateral attack of a judgment in which a party appeared that has support all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And it has support in this circuit, as Judge Oldham mentioned with the PICO case, as well as the Brown versus Illinois Centennial Railroad. And with that, I will conclude my remark.
All right, counsel, we have both sides' arguments. We will get a decision out in due course, and you're excused for the rest of the morning.
Thank you, Judge. Thank you, judges.